There are more ways than ever to watch a movie. Online streaming to your smartphone or tablet, via cable to your flat screen, and you can always go to a theater. Which begs a question. How do you decide if a film is worth seeing on the big screen? Film critic Christopher Llewellyn Reid joins us for a look at our changing viewing habits in the digital age and how that affects what films get made and how they're released. What's ahead for films that aren't franchises with comic book tie-ins? Will gritty dramas and quieter comedies disappear from the big screen? And as Hollywood studios work to maximize profits and limit losses, are they actually pushing audiences to stay home? All this on Midday on Film, after the news. Welcome back to Midday Friday. It's time again for Midday on Film with Christopher Llewellyn Reid sitting in today. Linda DeLibro is not with us. She will be with us next month. So here's a question. When was the last time you went to the movies? Was it to see The Avengers or just Avengers Age of Ultron, which opened earlier this month? Or do you plan to buy a ticket to see Mad Max Fury Road, which opens this weekend? Do you feel the best way to take in a summer blockbuster is on the big screen? Is that a tradition with you? In this month's edition of Midday on Film, the changing nature of production and distribution of the movies and how we watch the movies. There are more ways than ever for audiences to watch a movie. Well, there's the theater, of course, but then there's online streaming to your computer, to your tablet, to your smartphone. There's cable, of course. There's Redbox. And even some people still buy and collect DVDs. And some people, I know one person who watches VHS still. Anyway, with all these alternatives to sitting in a movie theater, how have the studios adjusted to maximize profits? Is there something going on there? More and more, it seems that the big studios are focusing on what's known in the industry as tentpole films. Tentpole films, surefire hits that can prop up, as in the tent metaphor, prop up their finances, rather than what they call tadpoles, those smaller movies that don't come with tie-ins to comic books or other popular source material. But those tadpoles still have a significant audience, and they bring prestige to a studio during awards season. We're going to discuss all of this today. Much anticipated conversation about our changing viewing habits and how this is changing Hollywood with Christopher Llewellyn Reid, chair and professor of the Department of Film and Video at Stevenson University. Nice to have you back on the show, Chris.
Great to be on the air as always, Dan.
This is really interesting. So someone would say, well, how does this change the movie making? I don't understand. A movie's a movie, and they put it out there. If I don't want to go see it in the movie theater, I'll just watch it on my smartphone. They still have to make a movie for the big screen, don't they?
And they would be right. What interests me is this shift that we could be seeing away from a certain kind of moving image storytelling product, shall we say, that would screen in films, screen in theaters, and then eventually perhaps make its way to ancillary markets like DVDs and TV. We're seeing a slow erosion of that kind of production in the Hollywood studios as they focus more and more on these bigger and bigger tentpole productions, as you said. So films like Avengers Age of Ultron, which for 2 weeks in a row was making a killing. It'll probably surpass Transformers Age of Extinction from last year, another one of these tentpoles. And part of the reason and part of what fuels this is that there are so many different ways for us to consume media. And as you mentioned, streaming services such as Netflix and Amazon, which are now not just rebroadcasting content from cable and network television, but creating it on their own. And so we're in an age where we're seeing an incredible proliferation of this kind of media. And why do studios feel any need to continue to make these sort of grittier, less spectacular films if audiences are now beginning to expect that to be available to them for home viewing? So you're sort of seeing this self-reinforcing cycle where if fewer audiences are going to see the gritty films like Whiplash or Selma, and instead are saying, well, there's this great content for me at home, True Detective, Fargo, that gives me what I need for that kind of storytelling, you'll see the studios saying, well, we're not making money on these films, but we are making money on these big budget spectacular films like Avengers, the entire Marvel Universe. And we've seen different franchises over the last 10 years come and go. And as soon as one goes, the studio immediately starts looking for another such franchise. And so if fewer people are going to the theater for the smaller films, then the studios make fewer of them. And then instead, you have the talent who wants to make those kinds of films gravitate more and more to the home viewing distribution networks like mm-hmm. Amazon and Netflix and the cable companies. And so you then have more and more content of that sort appearing on those outlets. And so it's, as I said, a self-reinforcing cycle.
Okay. That's really interesting. I'm trying to distinguish how that is different from the past. Because in the past, the media past, or still part of the present, a studio does a big tentpole film, right? And it's also doing these tadpoles, which come in handy, especially in awards season, because that's the kind of those are the kind of films that Hollywood likes to award with Oscars, right?
You're absolutely right. But
so the change is that there will be fewer of those tadpoles produced for the big screen.
And, you know, it's obviously impossible to predict the future, but Hollywood has had various moments of crisis in its history. It's never been really a static thing. So if we look at the sort of pre-1950s era, when Hollywood was virtually unchallenged in terms of its cultural hegemony, movies were what people saw. Mm-hmm. And then with the 1948 Paramount decision that ruled that studios could not own their modes of distribution, they couldn't own theaters, that gave way to real competition. And with the rise of television in the 1950s, that, plus the fact that studios couldn't own their modes of distribution, started to erode that cultural hegemony. So that was sort of the first crisis, and Hollywood responded with various ways to draw people into the theater, including widescreen and color. Widescreen hadn't been used before at all to speak of, and color had been, but now it was used more and more.
Interesting point. So that's how they competed with television.
That's how they competed with television. And that was fine. But then, with the gradual erosion of the studio system into the 1960s, and with the rise of a new youth culture, Hollywood faced a new crisis, which was how to make films that would speak to this rising new group, hippies, young people, etc., mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and draw them into the theater. And they responded by making sort of these gritty dramas that we've come to define as sort of the American New Wave, which begins with Bonnie and Clyde and continues in with The Godfather, Taxi Driver, etc. Those films make good money. But then in 1975, with the release of Jaws, and 2 years later with the release of Star Wars, Hollywood figured out now how to make money like they'd never made before, and we're still in this age of the blockbuster. And so it's not so much that there are brand new elements to this crisis or the way that Hollywood is making films. It's more that we're now in an era where, because of the proliferation of other means of consumption, if there is so much media available out there for home viewing, and there is less need to have to go to the theaters to see these kinds of stories that are available through your cable companies or your streaming networks, then why would a big studio continue to invest as many resources to make these films?
I get it. And then it leaves the opening for Netflix, for Amazon to produce their own, and others may be coming along.
And in fact, the studios are making fewer films mm-hmm. Than they have before, because it takes a lot more of their resources to make these huge films. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not seeing small films.
Right. Or that we won't see them.
Or that we won't see them. And certainly these are, as you say, the prestige films, right? The ones that get nominated for Academy Awards.
Yeah.
And what you end up having is this interesting Academy Awards system where most of the films that are up for awards are not the big money earners. The one exception that proved the rule this year was American Sniper.
I was just going to bring that up. Where does that fit in?
Well, this is not a perfect description of everything that happens. There's always a film that rises and speaks to the cultural zeitgeist.
Right, and is certainly gritty and doesn't involve Transformers, right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, we are not a monolithic audience.
But you're talking about some trends. This is very interesting. So I'm going to speak to our listeners here and ask them a couple of questions with regard to this, with regard to what Chris is talking about here. What are your viewing habits these days, and how do you decide which films you'll go to see in the movie theater? And do you have lower expectations about seeing some of your favorite films, some of your favorite actors and actresses on the big screen, and content to see them at home or on a tablet, right? Can you give an example of, like, I think of Woody Harrelson and True Detective in the series that was on HBO,
last year,
with Matthew McConaughey.
Right, and sort of this era that we're in now, which some people call the new golden age of television, began, you could probably pinpoint it with the broadcast of The Sopranos in 1999 on HBO, because here you had actors who had, you know, made their mark, and, you know, they weren't necessarily big stars, but they made their mark in films, and you had some excellent writing, and it was, you know, again, to use that word, a gritty drama. It's about the, you know, the mob in New Jersey. Well, most people know what The Sopranos is about.
Right.
And that show lasted from 1999 to 2007, was wildly popular for HBO, and really sort of launched this era of prestige television. A couple years later, we had a show like 24, which not only was a gripping drama for television, but it sort of invented, in a way, this idea of binge viewing, except at that time it was through DVD. 24 is the show that first sort of proved to Hollywood that there was a real market for selling DVDs of television shows. And because you couldn't just watch one episode, because they would always end on a cliffhanger, and they
right.
were 40 minutes long, and
right.
and you just felt like you had to keep on watching, that was really one of the first times that we were sort of binge-watching TV after it had been broadcast. Now this is quite common, because it's available to us an entire season
That's
at once.
Interesting. So people who watched it from week to week and couldn't stand the tension, they decided, what, to have binge weekends of 24?
It was more that it was the kind of show that if you missed the first couple of episodes, you wouldn't necessarily try to pick it up later, or
right.
it was more difficult to do so. So there was a real market for buying the DVDs because you didn't have to, then you could just watch it all at once.
You know what I was just thinking of? This is kind of funny. Think of the made-for-TV movie back in, starting in the 70s or 80s, an attempt to Hollywood television. Remember that?
Uh-huh.
And it's become sort of, what would you say about it? If I say a made-for-TV movie now, a lot of people sneer.
Right, and of course that phrase, which, you know, I grew up with,
right.
has lost its meaning. I mean, made for TV movie, that could be wonderful.
That
right?
could be a great thing today.
But there was a certain for a while that phrase was replaced with a Lifetime channel. You know, we used to talk about a Hallmark movie, and then it became a Lifetime channel movie. And now, you know, what does this mean? There's an enormous quality on television.
Let me just bring this up before we get into our first clip here, and Chris explains why we're listening to it. The Homesman, with Hilary Swank, Tommy Lee Jones.
He directed it, too.
He directed it. You talked about this last year when it came out. You reviewed it on Midday. I didn't rush out to see it, although I really like Hilary Swank and Tommy Lee Jones, especially in a Western. This actually was a Midwestern set in Nebraska territory before the Civil War in the 1840s or 50s. Okay. Meryl Streep is in it. James
Spader.
Spader. Thank you very much. Isn't it? So it's got a great cast, and Tommy Lee Jones. So I didn't go out to see it, and then I just watched it on a tablet, right? And I regret that. I regret that I didn't go out to see it because of the scenery, because of the settings, where the film was made, the production qualities. I feel like I blew it, and I won't get another chance to see that on a big screen.
I think the trick is to hold the tablet really close to your face so it feels like a widescreen movie.
But other people must have this regret.
Sure.
You know.
But again, you know, many of us own really big TVs, which certainly do not replicate the widescreen theatrical experience, but it's certainly better than it was in my childhood, watching it on a black and white TV in my living room.
Yeah. I'll give you that.
And I guess it's really up to the individual viewer what draws them into the theater. I think for most people, it's cinematic spectacle, maybe also a certain brand pre-awareness, and this goes into the franchise thing, that you feel like you want to watch communally this property that's been transformed into a film with your fellow fans. I think there's an element of that sometimes as well. But it, for many people, it is a cinematic spectacle.
Are you concerned, vistas. Are you concerned that that's all it becomes, though? That's why people go to the movies, for those kinds of movies? And then you end up with art house. What happens to art house cinema?
Well, I think art house cinema, as long as there are enough people who are interested in seeing these films, is alive and well, but for small audiences. I mean, the Maryland Film Festival, Mike and Johns Hopkins right now, have been renovating the Parkway Theater right around the corner from another great art house cinema, the Charles. So bringing perhaps these opportunities for Marylanders and Baltimoreans to see smaller films. as I said, we can't predict the future, but as long as there are people willing to invest in the infrastructure to continue to project and display these kinds of films, then hopefully we'll still be able to see them in theaters.
All right, we have to take a break. When we get back, more of this discussion with Christopher Llewellyn Reed here on Midday, Midday on Film. A question for our listeners: when was the last time you went to the movies, and what brought you there? Was it a huge blockbuster? Do you just wait for those kinds of movies? Do you find yourself deciding it's no problem to wait until a film is released to Netflix or on demand or wherever now and just watch it at home? Have you become a completely stay-at-home film watcher? Tell us about your changing habits. 410-662-8780. Our email address for Midday is midday@wypr.org.
How do you know this place even exists?
I was born there.
So why'd you leave?
I didn't. I was taken as a child. Stolen.
You've done this before?
Many times. Now that I drive a war rig, this is the best shot I'll ever have.
And them?
They're looking for hope.
What about you?
Redemption.
Redemption. So that's Charlize Theron in the new Mad Max film, the first Mad Max film in 30 years. Mad Max Fury Road.
That's correct. That was Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron. George Miller, the original director, still the director of this fourth film. Oh. The first film was in 1979, simply called Mad Max. The second film in 1981, called alternately Mad Max 2.
34 years.
Or The Road Warrior, or Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. And then the third film was 1985's Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. I forgot Beyond Thunderdome.
That's
is that
right.
The one with Tina Turner?
That's the one with Tina Turner.
Oh, how could I forget that one? Right. I'm sorry. That is 30
and
years.
She, okay. And she sings the theme song in that film,
yeah,
too.
I know. Wow. I forgot. Sorry, Tina.
All three of those films starred Mel Gibson. And at some point, George Miller and Mel Gibson were in talks to have Mel Gibson come back. But this was a number of years ago before, Mel Gibson's personal problems came to light.
Yeah.
And plus, he is a little too old for the part now. So Tom Hardy plays Mad Max in a film that's not so much a sequel, a prequel, even a reboot, as sort of a revisitation of the same universe. And I have to admit, I spent too much time in the beginning of the movie trying to figure out how it fit in to the other films. And then I just said, forget it.
Yeah.
And enjoyed the movie. And it is one of the most hyperactive, kinetic action films I have seen ever. Perhaps only matched by Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior. It's really an amazing action film. Great summer movie. The script doesn't always hold together. And perhaps there are a few too many operatic moments when the film does slow down, but as a summer action film, it's really unparalleled.
Excuse me, when you say operatic moment in a film, what do you mean?
Well, for anyone who sees this movie, you'll know exactly what I mean. At one point, there's a tragic revelation, and Charlize Theron's character sort of falls down in the sand, looks up into the sky, and screams as the music swells.
Oh, okay. All right. Is she suffering from consumption or something? Whatever. Okay, I get you.
Yeah.
Now, why did you bring this up? I know it's a new film, you want to review it, but why in the context of our discussion?
Well, because it's one of the more interesting ways to continue to a franchise, but to do so for reasons that are not just mercenary. In other words, George Miller has had an idea for a long time of wanting to make another Mad Max film. And anytime you have a new entry in a beloved franchise, you have a built-in audience, right? So the studio is obviously going to be very excited to make it. And it's definitely, you know, could be called a tentpole, although is it really launching a new series? Well, maybe. Tom Hardy signed on to do two more films after this. So it could be launching a new, new Mad Max franchise. But it's much more than that. It's an intelligently crafted film, beautifully photographed. You do need to see this one in the theater to fully appreciate the action sequences. And what I like about it is, unlike the film that opened 2 weeks ago, the big Marvel tentpole, Avengers Age of Ultron, this is a film with, it obviously has some computer-generated imagery. There's a big sandstorm at one point that is, you know, quite obviously made by computers. But most of what you see in the film is in camera. You know, like Mad Max 2, The Road Warrior, it's got massive trucks and cars chasing each other across the desert, in this case, the Namibian desert. And it's all in camera, and that's what... there's something so palpable. It's what we love about George Miller's work, and it makes somehow those action sequences really resonate. So I'm a big fan of the film, despite the plot problems I had at times.
Before we start taking some calls here, and I want to encourage our listeners to participate in this conversation, because we want to hear from you about your changing viewing habits, how you make decisions about going to a movie theater versus watching a film at home, or even a decision about watching it on a smartphone versus a tablet or versus your flat screen at home. 410-662-8780. So you could say there are some films that you feel like was a waste of money. I could have just not waited to see it at home, but it would have been fine if it had just come into my tablet. I would have been fine with watching it on a tablet, right? I didn't need to see this on a big screen.
And it's interesting that you put it that way, because today, more than in the past, we really can say that statement, and it means that we can expect something to show up in our queue, let's say our Netflix queue, where we don't have to pay any extra money. We're already paying for our subscription. So if we don't feel like this is a movie worth going to the theater for, there's a good chance it'll show up for free, because we've already paid for our subscription, in our Amazon Prime queue or in our Netflix queue. And so it does take that phrase, I'll wait for it to come out on video, and transform it into something that is even scarier to the studios, because you know that you don't have to shell out extra bucks if you're not motivated to go to the theater.
I'm trying to think of an example of a movie like that where I don't really need the big screen, right? What would be an example of that? Nothing with vistas, a lot of action, a lot of talking, simple movie. I'm trying to think of an example. It's not coming to me.
Right. Well, you're talking to someone who feels like every movie should be seen
in
a theater.
I know.
But, you know, let's take a film that I adored called Whiplash, right, from this past year.
Okay.
I think it's an incredibly visceral movie-going experience, but there's nothing that the, you know, average viewer who maybe only sees a few films a year, unlike me, would necessarily think, oh, this needs to be seen in the theater, because it's a small movie in terms of where it takes place. It takes place in interiors. And so that might be the kind of film that...
That's a good example. How about Silver Linings Playbook, just from a few years ago? I just recently watched that again.
Well, all of these kinds of films probably, to some viewers, strike them as things that they could just as easily see at home.
Yeah. 410-662-8780. Ben in Towson, our first caller here on Midday on Film. Go right ahead.
Hi. Yeah, so what you just said, I completely agree with. So the first decision that I make when I watch a movie is how well it's fitted for like a big screen, if it's something that's really worth seeing, like Interstellar, for example, on like with these great visuals and the sound and stuff in like a movie theater, then I'll go see that. And then the second decision I usually make is how big of a fan I am to the franchise. So the last movie I saw in the movies was Chappie, and I went to see that because it's the director of that movie was the other one they did was District 9, and I really liked that. So I just felt like I actually want to go pay that money, I guess, to see that movie and support it also a little bit. And see it as soon as possible, I guess, because I'm a fan of the franchise.
It's interesting that you're calling Chappie part of a franchise just because you like the director. I think, though, that's an interesting association. I think most viewers probably wouldn't have necessarily known that Chappie was made by the same guy who made District 9 and also Elysium. But I do agree that cinematic spectacle and brand awareness, whether that brand is an actual series or, in this case, a director, do tend to be things that draw people into the theater.
Let's go to this other clip, Avengers. Now, you brought up Avengers already, but is there a particular clip you want us to listen to?
Yes, absolutely. Let me set it up for a moment, because the Avengers is part of this juggernaut known as the Marvel Universe, which right now is the ultimate tentpole franchise, because not only do we have these two Avengers films, the first released in 2012 and the second just two weeks ago, but there are all of these other films that all tie in together. It's this massive behemoth, if that's not redundant.
it's a Medusa.
It's exactly. Medusa's even better. All these tentacles are going out with different series. And in fact, it's even now overlapping into home viewing because Netflix is releasing smaller superheroes from the Marvel Universe directly to Netflix. Daredevil was the most, you know, was the recent one.
Oh, I started to watch that.
Yeah, and that's part of the
same.
It
wasn't bad.
It wasn't bad.
Yeah.
So
I'll go back to that. I think it's on Netflix.
It is on Netflix. Yeah. So the Avengers is simply the latest release from the Marvel Studios of this big juggernaut of a universe that they're giving to us. And, you know, some people like it, some people don't. I think it's representative of the strengths and the weaknesses of this particular tentpole franchise. So we have a clip in which we hear the ensemble cast, which includes Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Hemsworth and so on and so forth, talking about this murder bot, as one of them calls it, this Ultron, this robot that's basically going to destroy the planet, and how they got there.
This could have been avoided if you hadn't played with something you don't understand.
Sorry. I'm sorry. It is funny. It's a hoot that you don't get why we need
this. Tony, maybe this might not be the time.
Really? That's it. You just roll over, show your belly every time somebody snarls.
Only when I've created a murder bot.
We didn't. We weren't even close. Were we close to an interface?
Well, you did something right. And you did it right here. The Avengers were supposed to be different than S.H.I.E.L.D.
Anybody remember when I carried a nuke through a wormhole?
No, it's never come up.
Save New York?
Never heard that.
Recall that? A hostile alien army came charging through a hole in space. We're standing 300 feet below it.
We're the Avengers. We can bust arms dealers all the live long day, but that up there, that's the end game. How are you guys planning on beating that? Together.
It must be making gobs of money, huh?
It did. It was number one at the box office. I've lost track of how much money it's making. Yeah. But 2 weekends in a row, we'll see how it fares this weekend against Mad Max Fury Road. And I hope Mad Max runs it into the ground.
What was the Robert Downey film made here in Baltimore with Holly Hunter years ago about Thanksgiving with Charles Durning? Coming home, going home, home the homecoming.
Was it Home for the Holidays?
Home for the Holidays. That's Thank you very much.
But Jodie Foster, director.
That's right, yeah. And compare where he is now with all of this to a film like that, which I would be happy to watch on a tablet, right? I don't need to go to see a film like this. Look at the contrast in those two movies.
Right. Well, of course, you know, he's making a lot more money doing this.
Of course. Yeah. But you were saying before about how you may see actors gravitating to, HBO or Netflix. We've already seen Kevin Spacey do that, Robin Wright, right? Because that's where they want to be. Those are the kind of stories they want to be in. They don't want to be in these stories.
Or they want to jump back and forth so that they don't become fatigued from doing the same old, same old.
Right.
In fact, and that
Kevin
is
Spacey was in a Superman film, right?
Yes, he was.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe you heard in that last clip what I hear as the sort of performance fatigue in a lot of these actors.
Yes.
They're sort of doing the same old, almost like a sitcom that's gone on for too long.
Yeah.
And that, for me, is a large part of the problem with Avengers Age of Ultron.
Although, is that why you chose that clip?
Yes. You can really, there's a sort of smarminess that I think Robert Downey Jr. is now sort of stuck in.
Let's take another call. Kevin in Baltimore, you're on Midday on Film with Chris Reed. Hi.
Hi. I wanted to make a suggestion on something that I do for watching movies at home now. I put it on a video projector. And then I get the cinematic experience while I'm at home. And it can be, 10 feet across. I've watched Super Bowl games this way. It's really much cheaper, actually, than getting a flat screen television. If you're trying to get a big flat screen, you can get a video projector for a few $100s.
You explain that to me. I've seen rear screen projection. This is projected across the room. How does this work?
It's things you would want to have something called ultra short throw rear screen. If you were to do that, I use that for my theater company because it only needs about 3 feet, and yet it can create an image 15 feet across.
Kevin, what do you watch it on that's 15 feet across? A sheet of what is
it? I put it against the wall. I just play it against my wall.
Oh, you just played it. Okay, all right. So you need a big white wall.
It's kind of interesting. Okay. So he's creating a home theater experience that's much larger than just a flat screen TV. It's sort of, you know, as an academic and chair of my department, we certainly have classrooms where we have, you know, projection of that size, but you have a ceiling mounted projector, we have surround sound built into the room, so not everyone can recreate that at home.
Interesting. Dan in Charles Village, we'll take your call next. Welcome.
All right. Yes. This is a really interesting conversation. First of all, I'm anti-high tech, so I have no Netflix. I have no digital TV. I use an analog television. What I do is I collect over time, you know, DVDs and videos. Actually, I have a VHS player also. And I do my own programming, and it's a much, much richer experience. I also go out to the movies, obviously. And I'm not, you know, I'm not being influenced by outside forces like Hollywood or advertising. I'm basically going for a genre. Like, for instance, I love true stories. The title eludes me, but I love the movie about the recovery of the artwork from the Austrian woman, Klimt paintings. That was fantastic. I like science fiction.
Oh, the Woman in Gold, is that it?
Yes, Woman in Gold. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, and that, I mean, so I'm choosy. I actually read about the movie before I see it. Not reviews per se, but just the synopsis, just to know what the story is going to be about. And the same thing, you know, when I buy a DVD or a video, even though they're very inexpensive now, you know, I look at what they're, you know, what the synopsis is, and I take a chance with it, you know. And sometimes it's a lemon, and sometimes it's a winner, you know. But I'm having fun, and that's the bottom line here. And I'm not being influenced by what the latest trends are, and it just makes viewing a movie very exciting.
Very interesting. Thank you for that.
Yeah, that sounds like a great plan. Of course, if you look at the box office numbers for last year, it seems like most people, however, are probably viewing different kinds of movies than Woman of Gold or Woman in Gold. And, you know, Hunger Games, Mockingjay Part 1, Guardians of the Galaxy, Captain America, Lego Movie, The Hobbit, Transformers, these are, of course, the top movies of the year, mm-hmm. which explains why there is so much emphasis on Hollywood's part in making these. What sort of happened about 10 years ago is that the DVD market fell out. Because once we started to have other ways of watching movies, there was a panic that sort of overtook a lot of the studio heads when they realized that this sort of surefire income that they'd had for a while, first with VHS tapes and then with DVDs, and then they thought they might be able to pick up with Blu-ray, was no longer going to generate the income that they thought, mm-hmm. you know, it might. And mm-hmm. so they had to start looking for ways to kind of ensure the bottom line. And that's why we're seeing this shift, because people aren't buying DVDs the way they used to.
It's amazing. The history that you just went over there is compressed into what? You're talking about less than 20 years, 15 years? How all this has changed so much in a short period of time.
But it's been you know, the roots of it have existed sort of since the 70s. You know, George Lucas, Spielberg sort of created the modern blockbuster era. Mm-hmm. And so now we're just seeing a further manifestation of that.
I mean the change in technology, you know, how we can...
Oh, that is amazing. Yes, I agree.
How we can watch this.
And that is just even the last 10 years.
Now, I wonder, do you think, even looking at those numbers, those box office numbers, they are significant, right? That people will become lazier about this, about actually getting up and going to the theater.
Well, it's interesting that you use the word lazy, because someone that I know, who will remain unnamed, did, when I was asking him about his viewing habits, he said that it would take a lot to get him into the theater, and that he even didn't want to have to put a disc into his DVD player because that was too much effort. So all he wanted to do was cycle through the choices available to him instantly on Netflix or Amazon Prime. Yeah. And I've heard that said in other ways from quite a lot of people, and certainly a lot of my students prefer to cycle through the choices that are easily available to them. And so I think that I don't think that they're unique. I think they're representative of what might be a growing trend to just sort of see what's available.
Let's take another call here before our next break on Midday. 410-662-8780. We'd love to hear from you if you want to join our conversation. This is Derek in Rocky Ridge.
Yeah.
How you doing, Derek?
I'm doing great. I love seeing movies in the theater, but I have a four-year-old, so the last movie I saw in the theater was The Hobbit. So I'm extremely picky about movies I'll see in the theater now. And 1408, I actually like that that movie better in my house than in theater.
1408.
It was written by Stephen King.
Yep. And Nicolas Cage in this one. Is that the one with Nicolas Cage?
No. Matthew Broderick.
Matthew Broderick.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I didn't
know
see
this.
It.
I don't know this.
Was that who it was?
It's interesting that you, let's go to The Hobbit for a sec. It's interesting that you mentioned The Hobbit because did you see the first Hobbit?
I'm sorry, it was the last one.
Okay, well, the first Hobbit was an interesting example of trying to add even more new technologies to the cinematic experience to bring people into the theater. Peter Jackson, like James Cameron, who made Avatar, is a big fan of 3D technology and was trying to push mm-hmm. something called high frame rate technology, 48
yeah.
frames per second. And I have a clip in which we hear Peter Jackson waxing rhapsodic about these new technologies as a way to bring people into the theater. Whether one agrees with it or not, it's interesting to hear what some directors and studios are trying to do to enhance the cinematic experience.
Shooting The Hobbit in 3D is a dream come true. I mean, if I had the ability to shoot Lord of the Rings in 3D, I certainly would have done it. What I actually did on The Lord of the Rings is I had a 3D camera taking 3D photographs. Hopefully, one day, maybe even on 3D Blu-ray, we might be able to actually show you some of the 3D photos from 10 or 12 years ago. But now, the reality is that it's not that difficult to shoot in 3D. I love it when a film draws you in and you become part of the experience. And 3D helps immerse you in the film.
We're shooting The Hobbit at a higher frame rate, at 48 frames per second, which is twice the normal 24 frames.
The human eye sees 60 frames a second. So 48 frames is more of a natural progression toward giving the viewer what they would actually see in the real world.
The people who have seen scenes of The Hobbit at 48 frames a second often say that it's like the back of the cinema has had a hole cut out of it where the screen is, and you're actually looking into the real world.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I hated the 48 frames per second experience on Hobbit, and so did many audiences, so they didn't repeat that for the second and third films. But 3D definitely seems like it's sticking much more right now than it did in the 1950s. I'm not saying that all audiences like it, but it has not gone away as quickly as it did in the 1950s, and part of it is because it is it's a much better version of 3D than it was in the past. But you know, Mad Max Fury Road, I loved it. It was in 3D. That isn't necessarily what made it a good film for me, but it's just...
Did you watch it in 3D?
I did, right. But it's just part of the arsenal of tricks that Hollywood is using to try to make sure that you feel like you must see it in the theater.
By the way, one note, Derek mentioned 1408. I thought that was Nicolas Cage. He thought it was Matthew Broderick. It was John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson. I thought I saw all the Samuel L. Jackson films. I haven't seen. Did you know this movie?
No, I've never heard of it.
It's from 2007. A man who specializes in debunking paranormal occurrences checks into the fabled room 1408 in the Dolphin Hotel. Soon after setting in, he confronts genuine terror.
Wow.
Sounds like a Stephen L. King plot. We have to take another break. We'll come back. 410-662-8780. It's Midday on Film, talking about our changing viewing habits of movies and how that's changing movies. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday on Film with Christopher Llewellyn Reed. Dan Roderick's here. When was the last time you went to the movies and what brought you there? Was it a huge blockbuster? Do you hold out for those? Are you very careful now about what films you decide to see in the movie theater, whereas before you went to see almost everything? And maybe maybe you don't go to the movie theater at all anymore. You said you knew somebody like that.
Indeed. Yeah. And I think what's also interesting is that, you know, since the gradual rise in the 1980s of alternatives to network television, cable, and then since the rise in the last just, you know, 5-6 years of, alternatives to cable, and in fact, even throughout the 90s, the number of cable stations just proliferated like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
We no longer have any sort of single media event other than sports events like the Super Bowl that generate a communal viewing experience the way we used to. And, you know, as we have this diffuse audience, the question is, you know, have we lost something or is it just the world that we're in? And I wanted to play a clip from the still to this day most watched ever television episode, which is the finale of MASH from February 28th, 1983. The episode was called Goodbye, Farewell, Amen. And it's just a conversation between Hawkeye and Honeycutt.
Look, I know how tough it is for you to say goodbye, so I'll say it. Maybe you're right. Maybe we will see each other again. But just in case we don't, I want you to know how much you've meant to me. I'll never be able to shake you. Whenever I see a big pair of feet or a cheesy mustache, I'll think of you.
Whenever I smell month-old socks, I'll think of you.
And the next time somebody nails my shoe to the floor.
Yeah, when somebody gives me a martini that tastes like lighter fluid.
I miss you.
I'll miss you. A lot. I can't imagine what this place would have been like if I hadn't found you here.
So 121 million people saw
121.
That.
121. Is that a helicopter in the background?
That is a helicopter. They're on the top of a hill, and Hawkeye's about to get in the helicopter. He flies away, and he sees the message that goodbye that Honeycutt has put in stones because he couldn't actually say the words. He has trouble saying them.
They were white stones.
They were white stones.
Painted white stones something. Yeah.
But it's just...
Well, you're saying then we've lost that, except for the Super Bowl or
at least
big sports event.
In terms of home viewing experiences, there has been nothing to replicate that.
Let's take another call. This is Michael in Baltimore. Thank you for calling Midday. Hi.
Yeah, hi, Dan. Great. I'm really enjoying this conversation. And good. You and I have had a go-around in the past about True Detective, but I'm not calling about that. My question is, I'm not the kind of... the person that goes to see these superhero movies, which means, you know, nowadays I pretty much never go to the movies because it seems like that's all that's out there. But, you know, as far as like movies that are aimed at, adults more than kind of the, you know, lowest common denominator full of explosions kind of movies, are they getting sort of pushed out? Because it seems like, you know, we're lucky in Baltimore to have the Charles, you know, to see all kinds of films, but I guess, you know, a lot of places don't have that. So a lot of people like myself wind up watching, movies on, you know, through Netflix or cable shows, something like that. So I'm wondering if the economics of this trend are squeezing out, you know, a lot of, you know, sort of adult, not adult movies, but films that aren't just robots and explosions and stuff like that. These big popcorn movies are what gets people to the theater. So are they sort of squeezing out? Is there any impact on, you know, sort of independent films that might otherwise get to this on the screen that might not be?
Well, this is sort of what I've been saying in terms of the self-reinforcing cycle. Right? You know, if you become accustomed as a viewer to seeing only certain kinds of movies at your local megaplex and you do not have alternatives like the Charles or other small art house cinemas, the AFI Silver, Landmark theaters, then you are going to become accustomed to seeking that kind of moving image storytelling through whatever home viewing option you happen to have. And then you'll stop looking for those in the movies. You'll stop going to them perhaps if they come out because you're not aware of them. And then the studios make fewer and fewer of them. So I do see it as a sort of self-reinforcing cycle. But there is a rich tradition that is still very much ongoing of independent cinema in this country. And we just had the Maryland Film Festival. And there's definitely an audience hungry to see alternatives. The question is this media available? And, you know, a lot of these independent filmmakers are making a living by not distributing through theaters because there's no one to play their films, but through something called VOD, you know, video on demand, but VOD that they manage.
Right.
So selling their films online. And there certainly is a market of viewers who want to see alternatives. But then that's also self-reinforcing in a way, because if you're not expecting to find that in the theater and you have the ability to purchase it online, you'll just watch it online and you're still viewing the content. You know, no one's saying that film is dead. Mm-hmm. We're just talking about how do we happen to watch this media and will this eventually affect distribution patterns? And it already is.
Michelle and Rosedale, for your comments also about the Charles Theater. Go right ahead, Michelle.
Actually, I really enjoy going to the Charles Theater. I don't know if you can hear me.
We're listening, Michelle. Go right ahead. Yes.
I love going to the Charles Theater and the Senator Theater. I apologize if it's loud. I'm in a car wash right now. I love seeing classic movies like Birdman and Inherent Vice in establishments that have been there for decades and decades. And I'm willing to pay the cost because I want to keep these establishments going.
Yeah.
Well, that's good. Well, thank you for continuing, you know, to go see movies in theaters. I think that, you know, again, all you have to look is at the box office numbers to see that, unfortunately, at least right now, you're in the minority in terms of going to the theater to see those movies. And you named Birdman and Inherent Vice, two films I liked a lot. Birdman, of course, won the Oscar, but it didn't make a lot of money.
And with smartphones now, you can actually watch a movie while you're in the car wash.
Right. There you go.
Anthony in Fells Point. Thanks for calling Midday. Go right ahead.
Hey there. How are you guys?
Good.
I wanted to just make a comment that I think sometime in 2007 is when I bought my first Xbox. And on the Xbox, there was a way that I could see every video file on my computer, and there was Netflix streaming. Since then, the only thing that has ever been connected to my television has been whichever version of Xbox I happen to have. Right now I have an Xbox One, but, you know, then it was 360. And that seems to be not only the only way that I consume most video on the television, but it seems like every guy I know is doing the exact same thing, the only difference being, you know, maybe a different system than I have. And generally, when I do go to the theater, it's because it's either a film that I want to support financially for some reason, or, you know, sometimes I go to the Charles, or when I lived in Philly, there was a place called the Ritz, which is the same thing as the Charles. But I also wanted to mention the last film that I actually saw in theaters was also Chappie, like that other guy who called in, and it was because of the director. But the reason I got interested in the director was he directed all the really cool Halo commercials, and he was supposed to make a Halo movie, and what he did instead was District 9, and I've been into that director ever since, because it just seemed like he's such a good director, and not a lot of people end up seeing his films as opposed to the blockbusters.
And I suppose we should name the director Neil Blomkamp, and I was also a big fan of District 9, though not so much of Elysium. And, you know, Anthony's comments bring up a whole other connection, which we could do a whole other show on, about between video games and, you know, the current state of cinema, since there's a lot of back and forth and transmedia, where, you know, you'll have a show or a movie that's either based on a video game or that turns into a video game, and that's a very interesting topic as well.
Well, this certainly was. Thank you for bringing it to us, Chris. Christopher Llewellyn Reed is chair and professor of the Department of Film and Video at Stevenson University, and you can look for his blog. What is your blog called, actually?
ChrisReedFilm.com.
Well, you think I would know that by now. I just have it. It's one of my favorites, so I go there all the time. You can get Chris's commentary on this, more of this. But it's really interesting. And I like this idea that you just brought up, because I've noticed this myself. I said, what am I watching here? This looks like a big video game to me, and it turns out it is, many times. So anyway, listen, we have the weekend coming up. It's Preakness weekend. I hope you have a good time if you're going to the Preakness. Otherwise, just have a great weekend. We'll be back here for another edition of Midday on Monday. We're here every weekday, noon to 2 p.m. And Chris Reed and Linda DeLibero will be joining us again in June for another edition of Midday on Film. It's usually the first Friday of the month.
It might be later this time.
It won't be next time, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so Mad Max, go see it?
Absolutely. I recommend Mad Max in the theater.
In the theater. Okay, thanks, Chris. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too, Dan.
Thank you, everybody. I'll see you again on Monday. Oh, no, actually, you won't see me on Monday. Aaron Henkin will be here sitting in for me on Monday. I'll be back Tuesday.
Midday's producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producers are Michael Himowitz, Melody Simmons, and Connor Graham. Our interns are Aaron Morenzi, Alexis Kuhn, and Aaliyah Satterfield. Midday's engineer is Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.